Hi there, and welcome to Everyday Business with me, Aidan Donnelly. I've been analysing and investing in companies for nearly 30 years, and I'm fascinated by how companies operate, the entrepreneurs who start them, and the business people and managements that run them. In this podcast, I'll be talking to a whole host of people with different stories, backgrounds, and journeys, learning about their businesses and gleaning some insights and lessons from their experience. For those that are listening, don't forget to like, share, and subscribe if you enjoy what you hear. And so, without further ado, to today's episode. I can't think of a more apt day to be releasing this episode, given it will hit your platform of choice just as the first competitors tee it up at Augusta National on day one of the US Masters. Derek Murray is one of the world's leading independent experts on golf club technology and the true art of custom fitting and club making, a passion ignited over 25 years ago following a visit to a custom fitting truck at the Czech Open. Throughout his career, Derek has worked with a who's who list of professional golfers like the late great Seve Ballesteros, Ian Woosnam, Michael Campbell, Sergio Garcia, Rafael Jacquelin, and countless other PGA and European Tour pros. Closer to home, he's helped Padraig Harrington, Darren Clarke, Shane Lowry, Gary Murphy, and Seamus Power with their equipment decisions. Further afield, he's designed and developed an exclusive brand-agnostic club fitting system, an in-house club fitting program focused on delivering not only world-class customer experience for the members of one of the world's most exclusive golf clubs in Georgia, USA. I don't need to tell you what club that is, but also designed a best-in-class fitting kit to specifically suit the course and conditions of play all across, referenced with demographic of the player at the club. He's worked with UPS, BMW, Home Depot to design customer experiences and events globally, and has a multi-branded travel fitting kit which allows him to attend events, golf days and private golf clubs around the world and provide advice and expertise on the best equipment to suit every style of golfer. He's the founder of his family business, 4Golf, run out of the Long Game Academy at Killeen Castle. Derek, you're very welcome to the podcast, and I hope I got everything.
Jesus, that was a mouthful, later. What?
A big deep breath God, to get through that.
You were beading sweat there going through that. Sorry for the big long intro, folks.
No, listen, that's the best part of it. Right, before we focus on the business, take me back to the roots of your interest in club making.
Yeah, good question. So, I guess I didn't, this wasn't something that I, you know, specifically tasked out to go after. This wasn't something that said, oh, I'm going to be a club maker, I'm going to make golf clubs, I'm going to do doing that. I got a job at the K Club back in the early days. Michael Smurfit kindly gave me a break and asked me to come and work with the late great Ernie Jones, who was the lead, the head professional at the K Club, and that was my lead into golf. But I was only 18. I was only just after my 18th birthday, and I got a job in the K Club, but only because it was close to me. Wasn't a golfer, didn't really play golf, like wasn't like a passion of mine. And then when I was in the K Club, I got a chance to be exposed to some of the tournaments that took place there, the European Opens and a couple of the events that that the K Club held, and ran into players like Raymond Burns, the great Ramey Burns, Philip Walton, Darren Clarke, these kind of Irish players, Paul McGinley, these lads that I had didn't really understand, you know, who they were, but understood that they were professional golfers. It was a tournament. And then kindly got invited to come out on tour with Ramey Burns. So Ramey was probably instrumental to this whole, I guess, longevity of my career in club making, because he brought me out on tour, which then I got to meet some of the guys out on tour who built the clubs. So the great Barry Willett, who was the head professional at Royal St. George's, he ran the Mizuno truck. And it was at that Czech Open in Mariánska Lázně that I first got introduced into what the world of club making was. I was sitting on a hill reading my book, waiting for Ramey to finish, and he walked past and said, "Who are you?" And a big broad English accent. He was about 6'3". He was a big joint of a man. He goes, "Who are you and what are you doing?" I said, "Oh, just waiting for one of my friends, Raymond. He's out playing golf. I hate to see wasted youth," he said. "Why don't you come up here?" He said, "Can you put grips on?" I said, "Nope, but I'll certainly give it a go." And he introduced me then to the crew on the Mizuno truck, who used to follow every event. They were the main tour. And then I saw Langer coming in, and Faldo, and all these players coming in and making finite adjustments to the clubs based on the conditions of the course. They were, you know, bending this, changing the weight on that, switch the shaft in that. And club making was kind of a little bit sort of early days in terms of technology, but it was very much, you know, finite adjustments to suit conditions of course, to shoot what they were trying to do or whatever was happening. And that was my first kind of insight into, and this is a really top level. So this is like, you know, this is like you're saying to a surgeon, what was your first, and you would see the best surgeon in the world doing work, right? This was top of the bus. And so there's a guy called Andy Kickadass who gave me a lot of help when I was starting out on tour first, and a lot of instruction and a lot of how to handle myself, how to approach, because I was very young. You have to remember, I was only like in my late teens, early 20 years old. But that was my first insight, and I thought, crikey, if these tour players are making these small adjustments to the equipment, I wonder could we make this for the normal golfer and have such and have a greater effect because the skill level wasn't as high. That was my moment, if that's what it was.
You raise an interesting point on this, and I'd be interested here: science versus art in club making.
Yeah, it used to be artistic.
Yeah.
So it was very, you know, I used to pour a load of, like when I was working for the tour players, I used to pour a lot of myself into the product, right? So I was grinding wedges was one of my things, and I used to love doing that, and I'd pour a lot of emotion into that, so there was a lot of me involved in that. So I was real particular about the grain. So when you're grinding a wedge, you got to keep the grain consistent so that it didn't sort of change when the club was being ground, so the steel stayed, like it looks like no one's touched it. That's the artistic side. And then, like everything in life, as time moves along, science becomes much more of a part of it, or even at some cases now, where it's probably more of the split. Whereas very artistic in the olden days, like when your grandfather was making clubs, it would have been more artistic, where the flavour of the guy making the club could be seen in the equipment. Now it's a lot more science driven, so a lot more launch monitor, a lot more data crunching, greens and regulation, all these kind of facts and data are fused together to create more of a club that's more forgiving, maybe, or performs differently, or performs at a certain level depending on what you're trying to get it to do.
And then does that mean that the modern players maybe don't have as much understanding of their own game because they're not having to kind of tell you what they want changed in it?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And in fact, you know, funny stories would occur where, you know, I was working with certain players who remain nameless, and they were at a press conference and I was there, and the next thing is they started asking him questions about the shaft and his driver, and he goes, whoa, wait a second, he said, my job here is to hit the ball into the hole in his least amount of shots. That guy there worries about what shaft it is, what flex it is, how it's performing, what's the spin on it. So you need a question about equipment, you need to talk to him. And everyone looked at me and I kind of went, I'm not talking to anyone.
It's more than my job's worth. Thanks very much.
Yeah, nod, high five, walk on. But it just goes to show that the player will give up a lot of that control about what's happening, as long as they're comfortable and happy and it feels good. And, you know, a lot of the time you're working more on the confidence side of the thing, the process, rather than the brass tacks performance of the product. So what the shaft flexes and weight is, it's more about is the player comfortable and confident, and therefore job done.
Why did you go your own company route rather than staying with one of the big manufacturers?
Yeah, so the tour, I don't know how some of the guys that are still out on tour stay out on tour. I mean, I don't know, maybe it was just that I was doing it wrong, or maybe it was I was too young, but I burnt out quickly. Right. It was an exhaustive travelling. The travel regime is unrelenting. So you follow the tour for every week, and it's a fairly heavy schedule. I also wanted to do something closer to home because it would make more sense. And then I also, my dad at the time was working in the quarrying industry and he hated it, so I'd sort of seen this vision where I could work with my dad, which I think would be a cool thing. Nowadays I'm not too sure, and I'm just joking. I'm just joking, Dad.
I know your dad and he's a very nice man.
Thank you. Yes. So it was more about the vision. Could I do something? Could I come away from the company and create something of my own? But also, more importantly, I needed to move into the agnostic side of things. So I didn't want to have a situation where you were hemmed in by the brand, because in order to be truly impartial and independent, you have to become agnostic. So you have to go from being brand concentric to player concentric. And also I wanted to make sure that we weren't hemmed in by the technology that that brand may be working on, and I would allow technology to come to me rather than me have to wait until it came to a certain point within a brand. Mm. And that's why I went fully independent when we opened up 4Golf first.
The business aim was kind of give that tour golf experience delivered to the public, right? What's the real difference to your average golfer from a custom set of golf clubs?
Yeah, I get this asked a lot. And there's a part of this, Aidan, is probably that I'm too passionate about what I do, which leaks all over the process, right? But the reality of it was, is that I didn't work in building clubs as my first job. I worked on tour first, right? So my process in my brain was, and I thought this is how the world worked, right? I thought you go to the range, you consult with the player, you hit golf balls, you gather data, or in which case feedback from the player, and then you write a prescription. Mm-hmm. You walk 25, 35 steps to a truck where there's another guy who builds the clubs. You hand, or in my case, it was, I used to do a bit of both. I would hand the prescription to, say, the guy in the truck, and he would build the clubs exactly as I wanted. I would then walk another 35 steps back to the range, hand the club to the player hit it and go, that's fantastic, and wins golf tournaments. Right, that's how I thought the world worked. When I came off the tour and went into the retail side of things, that wasn't how the world worked. How the world worked was, let's sell as much stuff as quickly as possible, with as little amount of touch points as possible, and let's make a bit of margin and let's move on.
Stack it high and sell it fast.
Right, and which is fine. Yeah. And I don't have a problem with that. But for me, I used to have massive problems with that. And because that was the way things were done, the industry made it okay. Mm-hmm. So then I'd go to events, for instance, when I was working with a player. I remember I'd go to the Pro-Am because that was a really good time to go out on course with players, right? So I'd go to the Pro-Am and I'd be watching and taking notes and on data on flight from one of my players, and there'd be guys there, normal golfers, and they'd always say, sorry, who are you? And I'd go, oh, sorry, I'm a club tech guy. I'm working with such and such. And they'd go, oh, what do you think of these clubs? And I'd be looking in their bag going, well, yeah, they're grand, like, but like I have a job to do here, so you know. But then he'd be like, see that loft, that driver, do you think that's right? And I'd watch him hit a couple of shots and I'd say, you're using the wrong driver completely. Yeah. Like, it's not even remotely close to you, and that's why you're really struggling with consistency, because the shaft isn't right for you and the head loft isn't right for you and the whole thing's just a disaster. How did you end up with that? And he said, oh, I just walked in and picked it up and put it in the golf bag. And I'm thinking, Jesus, there's no process here, like in anything. This is just like blind darts. I happen to hit the bullseye once in the dark and I think that that's how darts is played. Yeah. That doesn't make any sense. So I started to break this down. So I almost reverse engineer it, right? So how are we ending up with just that stuff? Well, I go into the shop, it's there, I put it in my bag, and my pro has a look at me and he thinks, ah, that'll be grand for you, sure, you're only a 26 handicap more, but you know, I'm only interested in low handicappers and blah, blah, blah. And I found a niche within the business whereby we could, even changing the length of it maybe, or changing the flex from regular to stiff, the subtle differences could make a difference to the player if that's what they required. But then I realised that that's not how the industry works either, because the clubs were already built. Yes. So then it created a bigger problem. We had to almost pull stuff apart and rebuild it again. Well, that's just not practical. So I became one of the world's biggest disruptors in golf retail. In fact, I was the world's biggest disruptor in golf retail, because I went all the way down the line and got them to give me the heads before they assembled them. And that was usually done in China.
Right.
Unless a couple of the companies that were in the US, like Ping. But I disrupted the whole industry in the early 2000s when I said, no, I said, this isn't good enough. People are spending a lot of money here and I need things done differently because it's not working.
And what was the industry's response to that? You know, did they ultimately, do they see it now where the benefit is actually, yeah, you can still do what you're doing, but there is another whole section of the consumer out there that actually is very interested in what makes a difference?
Well, to give you an example, so TaylorMade, when I started this whole journey, I think TaylorMade's custom fitting was 5% or 6% of their business. It's now north of 60% of their business. Okay, so the consumer wants it. And so you're right, there was a tremendous amount of pushback, like tremendous, and still is a little bit today. But fortunately, I had, at the time, I had a lot of people on my side. And I was starting to do some stuff in the US, which, you know, upped my stock, as it were. And so when I presented this idea to, you know, Chip Brewer, who was the head of Callaway Global, he said no, because he said that's just too much work. And then I met a guy called Andrew Law. He now is the guy who works for Adidas for Europe, EMEA. And he at the time was the head of TaylorMade Europe. So he was the head of TaylorMade Europe. And I said to Andrew, listen, I've got a really, really good, strong feeling for this. This is going to be huge. This is going to be the way industry is going to move. This way it's going to happen. Will you help me organize this? And he said, yeah. He said, if he came to visit me, he's a Scottish guy, we were still the best of friends. In fact, I spoke to him last week. He said to me, if this is something that you want to do, let's see if we can find a way. And what we did was we wrote the contractual terms around providing components from the golf companies to me. And I wrote the contract for TaylorMade, and I was the first client in the world to receive components from TaylorMade, and then for Callaway, because when TaylorMade did it, Callaway went, oh, we need to get in on this. So I helped TaylorMade write the contract, and then I've gone on to obviously secure the components for most of the companies now. And I was actually the first in the world to get Mizuno, which was a very arduous task because they're obviously Japanese owned, so you had to tick a lot of boxes for that. So it wasn't an easy ride, I can tell you.
The making of the clubs is obviously a passion for you, but what about the other skills to run a business? So happened there?
I'd have to say, like, I fumbled along quite a lot. And in the early days, we you know, there was a lot of mistakes made. We made some bad decisions, got some the wrong people involved in the business over the years. But, like, ultimately, you know, it was, and only in reflection now, Adrian, I've looked back, or even I say to myself, I probably should have been a little bit more astute with the business side of things, where I was so focused on the passion of what I was producing that the business just kind of just fumbled along. And in reflection, I think I would have preferred to have been more focused on the business side of it early on, but then maybe that might have affected the passion side, because I was unrelenting in terms of what I was delivering to the consumer, right? So it wasn't the right way, I think, but I had no education. You have to remember, I was a technician on the European Tour at 23 years of age. I had no formal education. I had no third level. I had no. I wasn't classically trained, was the word, because I used to go to events and guys would say, oh, where did you train in aeronautics? And I said, I didn't train aeronautics. And they look at you and you didn't go to university. And no, you didn't go to college. No, I did not go to college. I finished my sixth year, got a job in the K Club, and then I just it found me rather than I found it. And I've always felt as though I could be lacking, but because my life was at a million miles an hour, I genuinely didn't have time for education. And I was educated as I went along by the different companies or different situations where I'd be pushed into, right, you need to go to California, you need to spend time with our design team, you need to spend time with our R&D, go and learn what's going on there. And then I would search it out. I would go to, you know, Callaway became great friends, Ping became great friends, and they'd allow me to come to the factory and hang out and kind of learn more about what was happening. But the business thing kind of was by accident, to be honest.
It you see it an awful lot of times. I say to a lot of entrepreneurs, I say, look, you know, there's about five or six key skills an entrepreneur or a business owner has to have, and it's a big thing to ask them to be good at all five of them. And what you sometimes find is, like you, somebody has a real strong passion in one or two parts of it.
Yeah.
And the key is to try to either gen yourself up on the best of it, or get somebody in who's going to do the other bits for you.
Yeah, see, I have a horrific control issue.
Yeah.
Like you wouldn't believe. So for me, bringing somebody in, as much as we've had a few really good mentors along the road, and I still have a couple that I would speak to regularly. My friend John would be one of the people I would speak a lot to, and then Andrew I spoke over earlier. These are people I would bounce off a few things, and I am working on my next stage of this. But I used to struggle thinking about bringing somebody in. And we had great help from Enterprise Ireland and Guaranteed Irish. And these companies used to help us with some mentorship and send people in. And I would end up turning to my sister, Jill, and say, Jill, I can't deal with that. That fella doesn't know what he's talking about. And it wasn't that he didn't. It's just that I had this reluctance to kind of give up the control. So it's the problem. Yeah. It was, and I would recognise that it's an issue for me, for sure.
Working as a family, where does the business life end and the personal life start?
So complicated. And anyone that works in a family business, I'm sure there's a few listening, like, crikey, like, it works for the same amount of time that it doesn't work. And we had a time whereby, you know, I was so And I look back, I was so unrelenting in terms of my drive to achieve at the highest level. Like, I wanted to work with the very, very best in the world, and I wanted to work at the very best places in the world. And I literally would walk through walls to get to it. And I think that my family are the only people that could probably stick by that in terms of a process. Because I used to come, I remember coming home to Claire on a Thursday and saying, I'm going to America tomorrow. And she'd go, huh? I said, I got to go to America tomorrow. When will you be home? I've no idea. And we had two kids at home. Yeah. And I'd be like, I got to go because I've got to go work with this guy, and then I got to go meet this, and then I got to go here, and then I got to go there. And like, I was just, like, I think back now, right? And I'm thinking, I didn't even think about like anyone.
And yeah, it was
right?
just
I would
so
literally
focused.
And I remember having two suitcases at home, and I'd have one where I would literally come in and go back out again. I remember flying home from America from a meeting just for my son's birthday and fly out the very next day. Flew home, had his birthday, got on a plane, flew back again to America. So family is complicated. My sister is a part director with me, and she's brilliant. And like, during COVID and you know, during stressful times, she's fantastic. Mm-hmm. And she'll step in and she'll take care of the processing, and she does all of our internet stuff, and she's, like, she's brilliant. And like me, she's really good at what she does, but she's no clue about golf.
Yeah.
And so that can be sometimes hard when you're trying to, you know, get across. And I'm the worst communicator from a business perspective. I don't see things black and white. I think I'm autistic, right? And I tell this to everybody, right? I think I see like Rain Man numbers and stuff, right? And so working with Jill can be hard on her because I'm, you know, all over the joint, in her own words. And then my dad was obviously very much involved, intrinsically involved in the business, and builds all the clubs that we produce. And my mum was involved in the business for some time at front of house and accounts and stuff, and she's since semi-retired because we have a 98-year-old grandmother at home. So she works after her. Anyone thinking about getting involved with your family, probably don't, unless you have a really good relationship, because then it makes downtime complicated, because all me and my dad talk about is the
this
next
club,
build.
That club, yeah.
And that can be difficult.
But at the same time, as a unit, you have a clarity of purpose.
Oh my God.
Which focuses everybody, albeit coming from different angles, but the end point is the same.
I totally agree with you.
Yeah.
And like, I don't have any question in my mind that Jill or my dad would get it done. Like, no, I don't have any question in my mind, whereas we've had, you know, staff with us for over the years, and I would get fed up with them because they just wouldn't have the same kind of, you know, passion or, you know, sense of delivery or sense of perfection, or I want it so. And you know, that they would be okay with bits, this is okay, and I'd be like, no, if it's not excellent, it's not, I don't do it. We don't do it. And sometimes that was hard, whereas I know the family members would deliver irrespective.
And it's another thing I often see, it's that idea that, you know, if you want somebody to act like an owner of a business, they've got to be an owner, but that doesn't necessarily mean you have to be a financial owner. It can be that they've bought into the process. You can get somebody from outside a family that has bought into the process, that loves exactly, and then they view it as an owner, even though they may not be a financial owner, but they've invested emotion and empathy and everything into it, and that's what their investment is.
I agree with you. And it's hard to find those people.
Yeah.
Hard to find those people. We've had a couple, and we've had to move them on for whatever reason over the years. I'd say it's complicated would be the best word. My missus has never worked in the business, and I don't think I'd ever let her, because I think that would, you know, she'd probably see the true lunatic that I am and leave after minutes. But anyway, yeah, it's complicated, as you know, and I'm sure that other people that have family businesses find it. I know I've spoken to others that have had that sort of the difficulty in separation, which I think is, in reflection, is something I'm working on right now.
And it is, I see, you know, we've had a good few family businesses on, and they say, look, you go up, but there's a line drawn, and then everything else, you know, if it's a Sunday dinner, stuff is left.
Yeah, that's the hard part, because my dad loves talking about clubs.
Yeah.
But I think over the years, I've become the boss, which then I have to manage my communication to my father, for instance, whereas I'm the boss of the business, so I'm trying to tell dad.
Yeah.
Now, dad's been great. And like, we'd have a fight, and then 2 minutes later, he'd be like, oh, I'm sorry, I just a bit mad. And it'd all be fine. And Jill and I, you know, spark off every now and again, but we're getting better. I think when you get older, you stop all that, don't you?
Yeah, you sort everything out. Does it help with you in terms of the fact that you still have, if you will, the pro side of the business and the retail side of the business?
Oh yeah, so complicated. Yeah, so complicated. And luckily, like at one time we had 26 players on our books, across all tours across the world. And then in that we had a couple of collegiate guys and sort of, I guess, elite juniors. And I've pared that back primarily because, again, I'm getting old, and I made a decision there about 3 or 4 years ago that I'm only going to start working with people that I quite enjoy being around, and that makes it easier for me then because I don't have to be working hard at working hard. But it's really complicated, especially when, you know, you could be working with a member of the public is a relatively high handicapper, and you're completely and utterly clear on your objective and how to achieve that, because, you know, this isn't my first rodeo. Yeah. I'm coming up on 30 years of doing this, right? But the 26 handicapper has questions around your choices, and I'm thinking, you know, yesterday I was advising a number 4 in the world.
Yeah,
I'm pretty sure I've got the length of the club sorted out here, you know. So that's where the complexities sometimes don't line up. But like invariably, I guess the pros that I do end up working with and advising are usually vested in me because of how long I've been at this. So there's very
little friction.
And
do they come to you? That's the question.
Yeah, 100%. Yeah. Because you can't re-go the other way.
Yeah.
Because like the last thing you want to do on a Tuesday afternoon is walk up on the range and say to a guy, I don't like to look at that driver.
Yeah.
And he goes, nothing wrong with my driver. What are you talking about? And the whole cards come falling down. So yeah, I'd wait to be approached usually. Mm. Or it's a recommendation from somebody else.
Right, I have the question for you now, and then
easy now.
There's a second one, right?
Okay.
Do you obsess about the small things?
Oh, massively. I actually get twitchy. Like, we could have another great story about the member of the public comes in and we go through his wedge profile, and the wedges go, you know, 50, 54, 58, and I want 4 degrees between the lofts because that's how I space things out. And he goes, I usually play 52. And I go, well, no, because we need to have 4 degrees because then you separate the distance. Yeah. No, I want to. And I'm like, and I'd be twitching putting 52 in because he's made the decision because it's for him.
Yeah.
Whereas as a technician, I know that that's not going to work for me.
But he's not going to know whether it's a 52 or 54.
I know, but it still makes me sweat about the small things, right? And I get fiddly about detailing, and I'm real finite about stuff like that. Yeah. And it's probably what's, you know, drove me on is that the pursuit for perfection. Mm. Now it's an exhaustive process. Mm. And I get into my missus's car and I come down with her today and there's dirt in the car. I'm having like a meltdown. And like I'd be wiping the floors and like I'm just, yeah.
Yeah.
I'm working on it because I want you to tell me
the fourth groove Seve story. I think this is one of the best ones ever.
Well, I'll back up on it because when I got this is back out on tour when the great Seve Ballesteros was with us, and I still miss him, but when I first met him, I was introduced to him by a French man who said my name was Derek, but the way the French guy said it was Derry, and Seve picked up on Terry. So then I said, no, Derek. And he goes, see, Terry. And I said, do you know what? This is Seve. We're going to go with this. So for like 3 years, I was Terry. And so when he passed away, I mentioned to his son, Javi, I said, I looked after your dad's. He was the best man in the world. I miss him so badly. And I said, I don't even realize how much I missed him when he's not around. And he goes, yeah, me too. And he goes, who are you? And I said, oh, I'm Derek Murray. I said, I build clubs. I'm a club maker. And he goes, okay. I said, I used to do wedges for your dad for a couple of seasons. No, I don't recall that at all. And I'm going, oh, I said, Javier, I'm Terry. Oh, Terry, Jesus, yeah, my dad used to talk all about you. We never knew who you were because the names never matched, right? Yeah. So I was Terry. So Seve decides he wants me to do some wedges for him. So I said, that's cool. And we go out, and Seve was all about the ground, right, and the force of the ground and the feel of the ground and the strike, and that's why he used to hit a lot of balls on sand, because he wanted to feel the club moving through the ground, and the sand would only let it move a certain way. And he used to talk about the relationship with the ground. Now, be it wrong or not, because a lot of people nowadays are all saying, oh, the ball doesn't hit the ground until after the ball has left the club. And I said, yeah, but you got to allow a guy who, if he wants to paint this way, you let him paint that way, because he knows what he's doing. Mm. So he used to talk about where he wanted the wedge to be ground. So this is the sole of the club. So the non-golfers out there, if you flip the golf club up on its end, you'll see there's a bottom on it. And I would shape that to suit the way that Seve wanted to strike it, so that he could strike it a certain way. And I was kind of, you know, at the time I was thinking, you know, just take a bit of back edge off the club and round the heel and that kind of works because that's what most players like. And Seve used to go, no, 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 you see, you don't understand, Terry. I need the club to hit the ground a certain way, okay? So I need you to shape the club so that the club hit the ground a certain way. And he would just demonstrate with striking balls and he'd show to me and I go, I don't understand, Seve. Why do you want it in a certain place? And he goes, because I need to hit the fourth groove. And I used to go, sorry? He says, I need to hit the fourth groove with the wedge because that's the perfect place to hit it for the correct spin. So every shot on the wedge is fourth groove, groove four. So we used to have to shape the club so that when he struck it, he would hit the fourth groove or just above the fourth groove because that was his spot for hitting the club.
And did he always do it?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
And you tried it, you tested him, did you?
Ah! He's not the kind of guy that you'd go around following doing like trial and tests.
You did lose your cool with him, I remember. And you taped it and you were proven wrong.
I did, yeah. And I used to go back to the truck very frustrated and I'd be giving out to the director saying, he's over there talking about the fourth groove. Like, what the And we knew that the groove was there to channel dirt away, so striking it there didn't really make enough difference. And at the time, it was before the groove rules, so the edges were quite tight, you know. And I used to say, he doesn't hit the fourth groove, so that's all a load of crap. I don't believe that for a minute. And then I'd challenge it, you know. I'd say, oh, that was low in the face, and he would look at you, and he'd look back, and he'd look at you, and he'd go, see, that's because that's what I want to hit it, right? So low in the face to change the spin, eh? And I would say, oh, I don't think you hit the fourth groove, Seb, I don't think you do it. And he'd then stand up there and he'd hit like 10 balls in a row and they would mark on the fourth groove and he would be able to. So he did this thing. I remember Luke Donald was talking to him at one of the tournaments I was at, hitting balls out of the bunker, and he was hitting these flop shots out of the bunker, right, and really strong action where the ball would bounce twice and check. And Luke Donald came over, and because Luke was into his short game, and Luke used to say to Seve, you know, God, how do you hit that shot, that second bounce from the bunker? And I was standing there because I was doing wedge work for him, and he says, it's just just the angle of attack, okay, and then where you hit the ball with the sand, and then you create the friction and the ball spin, okay. And Luke Donald does this like passing remark. LD goes, sure, it's easy to do, like, sure, you have a 60 degree wedge there. I never forget Ballesteros looking at him, so you think this is easy, eh? And I'm looking at Seve going, oh, this is kicking off, right? So next thing you, Seve goes, the forehand, give me the forehand, eh? And the caddy lifts the forehand out and hands it into Seve, right? Now Seve's hit about 5 shots with this wedge out of the bunker, and it's one bounce check, like 6 inches from the hole on the practice putting green. And he takes out the four iron and he hits exactly the same shot out, 2 bounces, checks up, looks at Donald, looks at me, looks at the caddy, looked like there with his mouth open, full of dust. And then he turns to Luke and he goes, so you think this is easy, eh? So I do with 4-iron. If I could do with 50 to 60 degree wedge, I can do with 4-iron. You need to work on the 4-iron. And Luke Donald looking at him going, Jesus Christ, I'm out of here. This is not for normal public. Move along. Nothing to see here.
Was he the most influential to you from your time on the tour?
Yes, probably, but the skill that I learned with him is very unapplicable nowadays.
Right.
Because I wouldn't do an awful lot of wedge grinding for normal golfers, because the strike wouldn't be consistent.
But even
enough.
So, your whole approach, his whole approach to thing and to life and everything.
Yeah, but he like at the time, I used to think he was the biggest pain in the ass ever. Mm. Like he was so yeah. Let me frame this differently. I think he was, but only years later do you realise how important it was. The lessons he was teaching you, so the constant pursuit for that perfection, how to win, how to push, how to be the very best, and how to gather the very best around you so that you can be the very best. His passion for perfection was unrelenting. Like I would build hundreds of wedges, he would discard half and that they were no good. I'd have to start again. So yes, I think he was one of the ones that taught me the most. And then I had the great luxury of working with Ben Crenshaw, and I learned a lot from him then in terms of just, you know, the power of experience, right? Mm. So you get a chance to ask a lot of questions, which both players never minded me wanting to dig deeper. And Seve let me in on a lot of stuff, which I don't think he would have let into a lot of people into you know, what are you thinking? What I don't understand what you're trying to do here, so explain to me. And he would explain in his broken English. And the same with some of the other players. So I do think he probably had the biggest effect on me in latter years.
As you look back and you revise and about where you've gotten to.
I walked away from him, I'd say, a dozen times and said, I'm not doing this anymore, and take the and throw all the doughties out of the pram. I'm not doing this. He's driving me insane. Like, you know, he'd be sending you messages like in the middle of the night, and like, you know, he wants you there at 5 a.m. because he wants to work on something, and unrelenting. But then look back, that's what it did. That's what, like, Harrington's the same. He's unrelenting in his pursuit. Like, he'll do whatever it takes to get it done. And I think, yes, maybe, but there was other players that you pick up as you go along. Different players give you different insights into things.
There's an idea out there, you know, with success comes the risk of distraction. You know, as you get more and more successful, you branch into stuff you probably shouldn't do, or things like that. How do you make sure you don't lose the focus and the intensity that you have?
You're right. A lot of stuff passes your desk then as you start kind of get branching out and start working all around the world. And a lot of things come at you. You're right, and I'm an awful, like, yes man. So I will say yes to a lot of stuff and then realise, oh, I can't do that, you know. So then I have to back up on myself. I have to be careful about how I spend my time now. So a lot of the time I'm learning to say no earlier in the process rather than later. So I'd say to people, no, I just haven't got the ability to be able to deal with that. It's very hard for me, because I don't know whether people can tell from listening, but my brain is pounding at like 100 miles an hour all the time, and I sometimes find it difficult just to kind of come down a level and not do anything. So I spend a lot of my time, you know, not talking, to try and regather my thoughts and work on what I'm doing and trying to focus. And my sister's always giving me apps about note taking and take notes, and I've diaries full of stuff, notes and ideas and stuff that I'd like to do and stuff that I'd like to work at. So I have a big problem with actually the completion of things. I'll start stuff and then I'll struggle to complete them, and then I'll have to kind of almost like cram it all in at the end. So it's hard work. It's hard work to stay focused when all the stuff that goes on around you, and everybody wants 20 minutes with you. Yeah. I struggle to play golf now, because when I go out, you know, there's like a million questions about shafts and what's Rory using and why is he using that and what's that all about, and or I go, I went for a drink.
And we all become experts. Welcome to the Google world where everybody's looking up everything.
Well, not even that, but I go to the pub like, and a guy goes, right, okay, I heard about this new driver. Give me your 2 minutes. What? And you'd be regurgitating all the information that you talk about on your YouTube channel, you know. So yeah, it's hard to stay focused on stuff when there's a lot of noise, a lot of buzzing around.
Do you mind all the travel involved in the travel?
I used to love it. Now, yeah, I'm a bit more selective. have it down to a fine art, though. Like, I can sleep on an airplane in 25 seconds flat. I'll sleep before the chocks come off the plane. My missus still thinks it's unbelievable. How do you do that? I'd be asleep now before takeoff. Like, I'd be gone. And I learned how to sleep quickly and stay asleep. I can nap now and be brand new in 20 minutes because you kind of had to.
Yeah.
So it's a cool art now of being able to sleep quickly and refuel and then go again. I don't mind the travel, love meeting people and new places and seeing new things, but unfortunately, like, people think that it's great, right? And you tell this to people and people go, oh, it's grand, yeah, tournament. Like, you see the airport, you see
all
the golf club.
All airports look the same, all taxi cabs look the same, all hotels look
the
same.
Dude, I go from the golf club to the airport to the golf club to the airport, and like, you don't, and golf clubs are lovely places, but like, it's tournament week, right? And, you know, I remember being at a tournament, I was at the Open Championship in 1 year, and so I arrive usually on a Saturday or Sunday, and I'm working. So Sunday I walk past this gate or this door, and a security guard there, and I'd show him my badge and I'd go walk through, and I'd say, morning, walk through, walk back. I'm doing it for 4 days. Thursday comes, the tournament comes, and somebody has said to him, oh, people with black and blue can go through here, but people with yellow and blue can't, right? So I walk up to the door and he goes, sorry, you can't go through here. No, I said, how are you? I said, I've been coming through all week. And he goes, no, you can't come through today. And I go, dude, I know this is the biggest week of your life, But this is the same crap that I do every week.
Yeah.
I go through this gate, I go out that gate, and if it's not here, it's in Oakland, it's in Kansas, it's
wherever.
In Ireland. This is the same track. I wear this track out for the week and then I'm out of here. And he goes, oh yeah, you're right, I go ahead. So it sounds glamorous, but it's not that glamorous.
I like this question, so I'll be interested to see who you have, right? You have a dinner party with six people. There's you, there's me and four others. Who are they and why?
Oh. Well, I'd have Seve for a fact, and I'd have Tiger. Because Tiger's just like, he'd be my like, I've met him a few times like, and it's just, I still get the jitters.
Pounding tart.
Ah, stop. Like, he walk over. I remember saying to my missus, we went to the Masters a couple of years ago, and she came with me as a guest, and she said, and I said, we'll go up to the lawn, and we'll stand on the lawn, and I go, oh, Tiger's coming out. I said, I see all the security coming. I said, I know him, you know. And Claire's like, yeah, you do. I said, no. I said, I've met him a few times now. I'm good. Like, he'll remember me. So the next thing is, I'm standing there, and she goes, no chance. And there's a load of good people around, it's all buzzing because Tiger's coming. And he walks out. This is in 2019 when he won. And he walks out, and I go, Tiger! And he looking around, and he sees me, ah, Irish, and fist bumps me. Well, I swear to God, it was like God reached out and fist bumped me, because the whole place went, who's your man? Jesus, is your man bumping Tiger? And I'd have Tiger, and I'd have Seve, because I'd love a bit of golf. And then who else did I have? We'd have to have a bit of a crack. I'd have I'd probably have my grandfather, because he liked a bit of crack, a bit of golf. And I think I'd have my wife, Claire. She talked to anyone. Great story about her. She used to come on tour with me. She was an air hostess, and we'd meet on separate trips. She'd come out on a trip, and my tour director was always talking to me about, you have to go for dinner with these players and build a rapport, build a relationship. And then, you know, when you're looking for advice, you'll already have the relationship. And I said, yeah, but Jesus, like, I'm busy, like, I've got a lot going on. And no, but take the time at night time and go to the dinner. And my missus would come with me to a tournament, and I'd say to her, look, there's my badge, you go up and sit in the lounge until I'm finished, and we go for dinner then. So she'd go up to the players lounge, and we're standing in the truck, and the next thing is my missus come back after lunch, she'd be standing talking to me while we're having a bit of a break. Next thing is, this fella would walk by, hey Claire, here's I, what's going on here? And the next thing is, another fella walked by, oh, hey Claire. And I'm going, this is ridiculous. I said, who's that? And she goes, oh, I think his name is David. I said, Claire, that's Davis Love III. I said, he's number four in the world. I says, what are you doing talking to him? Oh, he's up in Players Lounge. And I just said hello, and he said hello, and I said, oh, where are you from? And he said, North Carolina. And I said, oh, have you got any kids? And then she goes, I was just talking about, you know, his family and stuff. And my tour director goes, a French guy, he says to me, I think we need to sack Derek and hire Claire. Because she used to go up to the lounge and talk to them about life.
Yeah.
And no golf, because she doesn't golf, right? So they were like, this is great, somebody talking to me about nothing about golf and not about my family. So,
well, it's interesting, because I remember a guy who did a bit of driving on the tour for people, you know, the players, driving the players in and out. And he always said, all of the players that he got on best with, he's a big golfer, but he never talked about, they never wanted to talk about golf.
No.
So that's all they ever got to talk about. They wanted somebody to talk about anything but golf.
Anything. And she was all about kids and family, and oh, I have this, I had two boys at home, and la 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 la, and I do this and I do that, and I fly for Aer Lingus and la la la. So anyway, that's so she got on really well. But it's funny where she had a great rapport because she wasn't talking about golf.
How do you feel about what you've done in the company already?
Yeah, it's a good question. I never really felt like I had done good, and I never felt proud about what I'd done. And it's only now, as I get older, I hit the 50 mark last year, and I'm only starting to look back and think, wow, I've actually done quite a lot. And I didn't realise how much I'd done until I got a chance to kind of reflect on what I'd done. And I think COVID did that a little bit for me, where I had to come off the hamster wheel. And now I'm thinking, geez, yeah, we've done some good stuff. I've had a brilliant life of it. The problem is trying to find the next peak, right? Because I've been up, you know, I've been up Everest twice, not physically but mentally. I've done what I wanted to do. I hit my peak, and then I hit a peak again. I've worked with who I wanted to work with. I've met who I've wanted to meet. I've worked in the right places. I've done what I've wanted to do. The thing is now to find the next peak, right?
Well, where can the business ultimately get to then?
We have to be able to scale it.
Yeah.
So this is like, how do I take my knowledge and allow a lot of people access to it?
Yeah.
So I think that's coming, and that's one of the things I'd like to do is design and develop a remote fitting platform. And that's something that I'm really that's starting to I'm starting to feel the fire of that again, where, you know, and I think it's going to end up being like an AI swing developed program that will be able to we went into the hospital recently. I'm going to go right on a tangent for you. Yeah. Right, we went into a hospital recently and my son hurt his wrist, and they scanned it and the doctor said, have you heard of AI? And I'm like, I have, let me see what's going on. And they used the scan on the bone and an AI program to scan the density of the bone to see whether or not it's broken or not, right? And he says the future will be scan, it will go through this program, and then you will either see the doctor if you don't need to, or you'll be sent home, or you'll be sent to get it cast. And I thought, well, if they're using this for scanning bones, why can't we scan swings? So my brain is now going there, so that's where my next peak will be.
What advice would you give young people?
A friend of mine, I was talking to him recently about education. That was one of the things I didn't do. I was life educated, not, you know, formally educated. Now, that has its keys and its benefits, right? And we'll all know that. But I think the education gives you the permission. And then your attitude and your work ethic gives you the progression. I think in order to get where you need to go, you need the permission first. And I think education's important. So my view would be, if you're young and you're thinking about doing something that's a bit out there, make it as out there as you can, but I think educate yourself so you have the permission to come into the room, and then it's up to you as to how you want to move forward with your attitude, your application, your work ethic, whatever it is, to progress, right? But the education is important nowadays, so try to get as tooled up as you can. And that isn't like Trinity for 4 years, yeah. Right? That's just educate yourself in as much as you can in whatever field you're thinking about. But be able to kind of move if you have to, because a lot of kids get locked in, right? And then they're like, oh, I have to do a business degree and therefore I have to work in business.
Yeah.
You could have a really successful milk round.
Yeah.
And dude, as long as it's successful, it's successful, right? But for me, I would educate first. And I educated myself, but I educated myself on tour. I said to myself, well, if I'm not going to go to college, I got to go on the tour. Because if I don't get gold certified, I can't be silver certified or bronze certified, because I ain't got the gold, right?
Yeah.
So I said, work on tour and create my life there, and then go to the companies and feed yourself full of information from them so you can go onto the range and be fully confident if you turn around to Seve Ballesteros and say, I think the shaft in that driver isn't right for you, and be fully confident that you're making the right decision. My old boss used to say, when I got really good at what I was doing, he says, you don't actually get better at this job, you just get quicker at making very important decisions.
Yeah. Who was the best ball striker you ever saw?
Rory McIlroy.
Without a doubt.
Oh, by a stretch, yeah.
Why?
I saw him when he was 12. I met him when he was 12 years of age. He was at an Irish panel training session in City West, the old City West. And Howard Bennett was the head coach at the time. He says to me, have you seen this new kid from the north of Ireland? I said, no. He said, he's out in the bays. He's out there with his dad. Go out and have a look at him and tell me what you think. And I was like, oh, I haven't got time for this, Howard. I'm trying to do stuff with this. I was with the senior elite team, so Noel Fox and all that crew. I was looking after all their stuff. And this is a 12-year-old kid coming in the range. You're like, ah, oh, for God's sake, really? I have to go out and listen to this fella. See this. Anyway, out to the range, and I see Jerry standing there, and I walk up, and I can't see the kid because he's underneath the barriers around the range, right? So I walk up, look over, and this little fella was a hat pulled down. He's beating balls. And I said, how are you doing? I said, how are you doing? I'm Jerry. Hi, Jerry. I'm Derek. Nice to meet you. I work with Howard. I'm doing the clubs and stuff. Oh, yeah. Nice to meet you. Blah, blah. This is my son, Rory. Ah, how are you, Rory? How are you doing? What about you? And the next thing is he starts hitting balls, and I say, hey, Rory, hit a big high fade around that tree there. It was a big tree in the range. Hits this big high cut. And I go, can you hit it low? Hit that tire over there on the left on the 180. And he hits this low stinger. And I'm going, wow. That's kind of cool. Hit it higher, hit it lower, hit it left, hit it right, no problem, full balance. And then some of the kids came down, they were hitting balls, and I said, hey, come here, kids, I want to show you something. hey Rory, hit that shot again, that big high one round the tree. Hits it low at the tyre. Oh, shots on call, I'm calling him out. And the next thing is I said, now Rory, tell the group there about how you, you know the way you moved your feet there and you changed your ball position there to just run it higher. And then, and he's looking at me and I go, so you know the way when you move, you changed, you opened your stance there and you moved the ball back.
It was all subconscious.
And he goes, Derek, I kind of just look and see the shot and then I kind of just hit the shot. And I'm looking at him and looking at his dad and I'm looking at Rory. So I said, you weren't thinking about, and he goes, no. And I said, move along, folks, there's nothing to see here. This is pure, when they talk about God-given talent, right, and they use this token, they talk about O'Driscoll or they talk about, oh, he was God-given, he was God-given. And you could say that he worked really hard at it. This kid broke the mold in terms of God-given talent. They say you did the 10,000 ball rule, you hit 10,000 balls, you become Brendan Tiger, talked about it. Nah. It's this young fella.
This is DNA.
Oh, Jesus, this guy hits the ball. It's like the noise. The other player who actually, funny enough, when he hits balls on the range, I can still tell, is Ian Woosnam. Ian Woosnam had the strongest ball strike of the, on the planet. I used to stand on the range and I'd be standing there working with a player. Next thing is I'd, you'd feel it through the ground. Oh, Woosie's hitting balls. Look around. There he was. Real strong, real delivered strike. You'd feel it in the ground. Yeah, so yeah, but Rory would be
up there.
He's miles ahead of him. If he just realises how brilliant he is, he won't stop winning. He just needs to realise how brilliant he is.
Now
I'm fed up telling him.
Now the last question comes from the Black Book. I don't know what it is.
I'm very nervous about the Black Book.
Well, so am I. Most
it's like
times,
Eamon Andrews. Most remember, times this is your life.
Yeah, well, most times I open this up and I've gotten lucky all the time. So we'll see.
Right, go for it.
All right, this is actually not a bad one. What is your motto or credo in your life and career? Do you have a motto or a thing that you live by?
My wife is my CEO. So
okay. So explain, please.
Right, so my missus is my CEO, right? So she's the CEO of me. So whenever I'm trying to, you know, think about something to do, I'll always push it past Claire, right? Because the family are in the business, it's very hard to have a conversation around stuff because you don't really have anyone to bounce off. And then in terms of mentorship, other people would have more of a business side. But she's always the most grounded person that I have, that I go to. So my motto, be that the motto or be it, find somebody that will not tell you, you know,
what you want to hear.
In my life, right, my world is built around yes men, right? So tour players surround themselves with yes men. Oh, I'm thinking about making a small change in my swing. Oh, that's a great idea. Let's do that. Yeah. Or I'm thinking about doing this. Oh, yes, that's brilliant. There's very few people that will actually step in and go, actually, that's not a good idea. I think that's shite. Yeah. Let's not do that.
Yeah. You're a fruitcake if you do that.
A little bit, but also because the confidence level is such that it's so harboured, you have to try and mind that. No isn't really a word that's kind of liked. So I would always find with my missus, she'll always tell me, nope, that's not a good idea. Or I wouldn't have done that. Or you need to be careful about how you do that. And for years, I never used to rely on her. I used to just go ahead and barrel ahead and do my own thing. Like, even like now, I'm packing my gear, right, going to the Masters. And I'm thinking, she'd be like, nope, put that in there. And that goes with that. And that goes with that. Right? Because I used to be so blinded by everything and so focused on what I was doing that I used to even forget what the hell I was going, where I was going, what I was doing, what I'm wearing, what's going on, like just lost, right? So I would say my motto would be, find yourself a personal CEO and push everything through them.
That's a good one. Well, that's it for this episode of Everyday Business with me, Aidan Donnelly. I would just like to thank my guest, Derek Murray. Don't forget to like, share and subscribe or comment if you enjoyed what you heard. Many thanks and see you next time.
The participants in this podcast have done so for the purpose of sharing their own individual business experiences. Some are clients of Davy and some are not. They have not received a gratuity or other payment for their time in making the podcast. The views expressed throughout are their own. Warning, the information in this podcast is not a recommendation or investment research. It does not purport to be financial advice. You should speak to your advisor in the context of your own personal circumstances prior to making any financial or investment decision. In the Republic of Ireland, J&E Davy Unlimited Company, trading as Davy and Davy Private Clients, is regulated by the Central Bank of Ireland. Davy is a Davy Group company and also a member of the Bank of Ireland Group. In the United Kingdom, Davy Private Clients UK, Davy UK and Davy Capital Markets UK are the trading names of J&E Davy UK Limited. J&E Davy UK Limited is authorised and regulated by the Financial Conduct Authority. J&E Davy UK Limited is a Davy Group company and also a member of the Bank of Ireland Group.